Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, Executive Director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, who discusses her group's response to Donald Trump's militarized takeover of Washington, D.C., and his threat to occupy other U.S. cities. Jason Stanley, Professor of Philosophy at the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto, who explains why he chose to leave the U.S. and assesses Trump's last 7 months of authoritarian rule. And Javier Dejanan, an attorney representing one of 61 Stop Cop City defendants in Atlanta, who talks about the dismissal of domestic terrorism charges against his client and the possible impact it may have on other defendants in the case. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian reports an unknown respiratory disease, possibly COVID, has spread among detainees at the Alligator Alcatraz detention camp in the Florida Everglades. Attorney Eric Lee, who represents detainee Luis Velasquez, a Venezuelan national, says conditions in the facility deteriorated recently after a large number of detainees were transferred there by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Lee said his client told him in a phone call that he had pleaded for medical attention for 48 hours after having difficulty breathing and eventually collapsed inside the metal cage in which he and dozens of other inmates were being held. The detainee was later transferred to an ICE facility in Texas. Protesters in front of the Everglades prison camp have counted an increasing number of ambulances entering and exiting the facility. Lee called the hastily constructed tent city a petri dish for disease. A female corrections officer assigned to work at the Everglades camp claims she contracted COVID due to unsanitary conditions there and was later fired. Rural America is preparing for deep cuts to the nation's Medicaid program, which funds most mental health care in small towns. Health experts say Trump and the Republicans' draconian federal budget that slashed social safety net programs, while giving billions of dollars in tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans, will lead to a dangerous new mental health crisis. Under new Medicaid rules, millions of low-income patients will lose their health insurance coverage, causing many rural health centers to close amid the rising demand for services from uninsured patients. As a result, many low-income families will be forced to pay for mental health services out of pocket and travel many more miles to receive mental health care. With an increased financial burden, a large number of patients will likely forego care for their depression, bipolar disorder, and other serious mental health conditions. In coming years, Medicaid enrollees will face eligibility checks twice a year and increased work requirements. Critical care physician Dr. Heidi Alvary commented on the irony of the situation where people are mandated to work, but with untreated mental illness, they'll be unable to. The BBC reports thousands of North Korean laborers have been sent to Russia to work under harsh conditions to fill a labor shortage caused by Moscow's ongoing war in Ukraine. Since Vladimir Putin's 2022 invasion, Russia has turned to North Korea for ammunition, artillery shells, drones, and soldiers to assist in their war effort. These laborers, who work up to 18 hours a day, are constantly monitored by North Korean security agents and are severely limited in their movements. One worker interviewed by the BBC said he felt like he was in a labor camp, a prison without bars. Most North Korean workers go to Russia hoping to escape poverty and save enough money to buy a house for their family or start a business when they return. But the bulk of their earnings in Russia are sent straight to the North Korean state as loyalty fees. The remaining fraction of workers' pay is released to them only when they return home, a tactic used to prevent unhappy workers from running away. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Donald Trump, following a pattern of inventing false crises to justify his use of extraordinary executive power, declared a public safety emergency in Washington, D.C. on August 11th, deploying 800 National Guard troops to support hundreds of federal law enforcement officers who he had ordered in just days earlier. Trump said he was sending in the National Guard and taking control of the city's police department to crack down on crime and homelessness that he said was necessary to rescue our nation's capital from crime, bloodshed, bedlam, squalor, and worse. Trump mentioned that he was responding to news that a former Doge employee had recently been beaten in a failed unarmed carjacking attempt. Responding to the unprecedented order, Washington, D.C.'s mayor, Muriel Bowser, rejected the president's claim of a dangerous crime wave, declaring that while there had been a spike in crime during the COVID pandemic, violent crime in the city had now declined to a 30-year low. As he announced his emergency declaration in Washington, D.C., Trump threatened to deploy the military to other major U.S. cities, including New York, Los Angeles, Baltimore, Chicago, and Oakland, California. Your reporter spoke with Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, co-founder and executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Here she discusses her group's response to Trump's militarized takeover of Washington, D.C., and growing concern that this is another dress rehearsal, along with Los Angeles, for the future deployment of U.S. troops to majority-minority cities across the nation, and the possible invocation of the Insurrection Act and suspension of constitutional rights in advance of the 2026 midterm election.
Well, we have a combination of actions that are happening from Trump's authoritarian effort to impose basically what we view as a prototype police state in Washington, D.C. And I think it's important to recognize it as that because not only is it an effort to basically establish an occupation force in the District of Columbia, but it's a model effort, an effort that he openly acknowledged he is planning to deploy on cities across the United States and urban environments. And it's really an effort to normalize the militarization of our cities in the United States so that we're seeing, you know, National Guard troops. But the multi-pronged effort is he both called out the National Guard, which under sort of kind of a quirk of the law and under the D.C. Home Rule Act, Section 740, in most places, in most actual states, because we are still a colony, we don't have autonomy, we don't have statehood, the president acts as the governor. So the president actually can call out the National Guard. But then in addition to calling out the National Guard under Section 740 of the Home Rule Act, what he did was move to federalize the district's police. So he has what is a Title 32 deployment of the National Guard, then under Section 740, federalizing and trying to put the federal police under the direction of the federal government. But what he also did is several days before those two executive orders issued last week, days before he started sending hundreds of federal law enforcement officers into the streets of the District of Columbia to carry out law enforcement activities on, you know, streets that they're utterly unfamiliar with. So you have FBI agents, you have a growing saturation of Homeland Security agents. So I say that to sort of set the stage for now, what is it that we're seeing here night after night? And so we have these sort of roving mobs of federal law enforcement that are setting up checkpoints, that are just walking around and assaulting and tackling food delivery drivers, that are engaging in just constant racial profiling, that are harassing the residents of the district, that are grabbing people and detaining them and taking them into detention for deportation. In addition to just the show of armored cars and military personnel in uniform all over the place, primarily in major downtown like National Mall and Union Station areas.
Donald Trump is quite clear that he's threatening military occupations of other majority-minority cities across the U.S. There is a prohibition on the U.S. military being deployed to cities to engage in police work or law enforcement. Called the Posse Comitatus Act. Maybe you can talk to us a little bit about what's the legal battle ahead to stop what's going on that's clearly unconstitutional.
Well, that's right. The Posse Comitatus Act does stop military deployment, but these are the workarounds that the Trump administration is hoping to get at. The District of Columbia, of course, being the first measure for them because the president does have the right to call out the National Guard. But in other states, and this is like what happened in California, was the issue of when can the federal government overstep the governor and basically federalize the National Guard. So there's a distinction between something that's called a Title 32 deployment or when states cooperatively send their guards to other states, and then a Title 10 deployment, which is a different federalization circumstance. So there are standards that have to be met in order to do that. And there is no doubt, I mean, there's litigation in California right now on this, but there is no doubt that there will be a serious fight over any effort to be sending militarized troops into other states. That's also why we think the district becomes very important as an initial ground, because it is trying to get all of us, not just in the district, but around the country, to sort of get used to this idea that we would just have these basically occupying forces on our corners, that we would be seeing people in camouflage and fatigues and military gear is a normal part of our day-to-day life walking around, or, you know, just the incredible chilling impact that this has on populations who are being absolutely terrorized by the military deployment as well as the Homeland Security and additional federal agencies just tackling, grabbing, snatching people, profiling people. It's brutal and it's appalling.
That was Mara Verheyden Hilliard, co-founder and executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Learn more about her group's work and the militarized occupation of Washington, D.C. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since his return to the White House 7 months ago, the nation and the world have witnessed Donald Trump and his administration implementing a flood of extremist anti-democratic policies, including the often violent mass deportation abductions being carried out by masked ICE agents, attacks on judges, universities, media companies, law firms, and the demonization and termination of anyone associated with diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. We've seen the deployment of National Guard troops and Marines to Los Angeles, and the more recent emergency federal takeover of Washington, D.C.'s police department, with Trump sending some 800 National Guard in response to what he falsely claims is a situation of complete and total lawlessness. Trump, who has long embraced censorship of facts and opinions with which he disagrees, has ordered a comprehensive audit of the federally funded Smithsonian Institution's 8 museums to ensure their exhibitions align with his own views. Your reporter spoke with Jason Stanley, who had since 2013 been a professor of philosophy at Yale University, where he'd written his best-selling book titled How Fascism Works. But in March, Stanley announced he would be quitting his position at Yale and leaving the U.S. for Canada because he wanted to raise his kids in a country that's not tilting towards a fascist dictatorship. Stanley will be joining Yale historians Timothy Snyder and his wife Marcy Shore, who also study fascism, to take new positions at the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. Here, Professor Stanley explains why he chose to leave the U.S. and the Trump regime's current effort to alter and censor history a topic he addressed in his recent book titled Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future.
Fighting fascism is hard, but relocating to another country with your ex-wife and two young kids is even harder, if anything. It's just a very significant thing to leave your home country with your kids. Of course, there's one sort of boringly obvious perspective on the choice I made, which is that I was sending an alarm to Americans, and I was definitely doing that. That was my intent, and it was sort of more effective than all the books I've written together, I think. And so it did what I wanted it to do. You know, if no one had noticed or talked about it, then it would have been really hard now that I'm dealing with all the practicalities of moving my life. I think it was effective in that regard. But really, the real part of the story will be, what will I do in Canada? What will Tim Snyder, Marcy Shore, and I do in Canada at the Monk School? I want to go there and create a place where academics, journalists, civil society leaders can gather from different countries, from backsliding democracies, can gather and do democracy work in safety. This is a global fight we face. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've noticed from my friends in different countries, including the United States, is how monomaniacally focused they are in their own countries. And the global far right, the fascists, are not monomaniacally focused on one country. They are linked together. For example, to give one example, the new reorganization of the State Department is going to have an Office of Remigration. Now, remigration, that's an interesting word that you might not have heard before. Absolutely. It doesn't really occur naturally in the English language. Mm. It was the slogan of the AfD, Alternative für Deutschland. It was their campaign slogan in the last election. And they're the fascist, the proto-fascist party in Germany. That is now the most popular party in Germany. In other words, at the very highest level of the Trump regime, they're in conversation and contact with the German fascists. I'm hoping Canada will be a place, and the University of Toronto and the Monk School will be a place where we can abandon those kind of parochial perspectives and bring journalists from Brazil, bring journalists from India, bring journalists from the United States, bring journalists from countries threatened by authoritarianism or under authoritarian rule, democracies that are now under authoritarian rule, like the United States or India, and pool resources and knowledge, just like the global far right is doing.
Professor Stanley, Trump has fully embraced censorship of facts and history he doesn't like. We've seen that, of course, over and over again. Most recently, he's ordered an audit of the Smithsonian Institution's 8 museums to ensure their exhibitions align with Trump's own views. There's no doubt that exhibits celebrating Black, Latino, Asian, LGBTQ achievements, labor unions, etc., will likely be targeted. Already, reference to Trump's 2 impeachments in his first term have been removed from one Smithsonian exhibition. It's as if Trump is using your book, Erasing History, along with Project 2025, obviously, as a how-to guide.
Yeah, I mean, it does. At this point, I really think that how fascism works and erasing history are being read and being imitated. I think it's, you know, it's just bewildering, but absolutely right. I mean, I wrote Erasing History in 2023 and the beginning of 2024. So I had some benefit of getting a sense of what was going to happen from what I was seeing being plotted. But it was also just like, if you're a fascist, this is what you do. The author John Gantz has said that fascism is a best thought of as a theoretical hypothesis that could then allow you to predict what's going to happen. And it's proven to be a very rich theoretical hypothesis. And the detractors, people who say you shouldn't call this fascism, will say things like, well, they don't speak German, they don't speak Italian. Well, you know, it's not exactly the material circumstances of mid-century Europe. Yeah. But if you assume it's fascism, then you would predict they would do exactly what they are now doing. taking over the cultural institutions. Fascism is a cultural component, a central cultural component. It phrases the greatness of the nation. It doesn't allow you to look at the problematic aspects of a nation's history. And what's, you know, really ironic is that we're explicitly being told that these institutions have to promote the narrative of American exceptionalism. But the narrative of American exceptionalism says we're a beacon of liberty. We're the home of freedom and democracy. Mm. So what they're saying is you need to tell people. We're going to force you by legal means to tell people that we're the kind of place that doesn't force institutions to do these things.
Exactly. In other words, exactly. You know, yeah.
It's as usual. It's one of these bewildering inversions. Every museum has to say that we're the home of freedom and liberty. Otherwise, you know, we'll fire you or throw you in prison.
That was Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy and chair of American Studies at the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. His latest book is titled Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Listen to our full 25-minute interview with Professor Stanley by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. More than four dozen people were arrested and charged with domestic terrorism in December 2022 in response to their effort to stop Cop City, the state-of-the-art police training facility in Atlanta that finally opened last year. Many of those charged had done no more than attend a music festival in a forest near the construction site. Those individuals and others, a total of 61 activists, were additionally charged under the state of Georgia's organized crime or RICO statute for their actions in opposition to the police training center. On August 15th, a judge in DeKalb County, the county where Cop City is located near Atlanta, dismissed domestic terrorism charges against one defendant, who had argued that her rights were being violated for having these serious charges hang over her head for 2.5 years. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Javier De Janan, the attorney representing Jamie Marsicano. Here he explains the impact of having these charges against his client dropped and what it may portend for other defendants and the outstanding domestic terrorism and RICO charges they continue to face.
While attending the Stop Cop City Music Festival in Atlanta, her and 22 others were charged with domestic terrorism. At that time, there had already been over 20 people charged with domestic terrorism, or around 20. And Jamie's case in DeKalb County was never indicted, and neither have around 40 other domestic terrorism cases in DeKalb. And so over 2 years passed now, and we decided to file a motion to dismiss. We had requested for a speedy trial and a speedy indictment in 2024, and then we did that again this year. But nothing happened, so we filed a motion to dismiss. The Superior Court judge overseeing the case held a hearing and ruled in our favor. The judge decided that the state of Georgia violated Jamie's constitutional rights by taking too long to indict and by not giving Jamie a speedy trial as she requested. Yeah, the judge in DeKalb County dismissed Jamie's domestic terrorism charge, which again was never indicted. So now Jamie only has the indicted Fulton County RICO case. But this is very uplifting because the domestic terrorism case is actually what really, really affected Jamie's life to begin with. The domestic terrorism case is the one that kept her in jail, put on an ankle monitor, took away the passport, got her banned from school, and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's very great that this case is no longer over her head.
Given that you said the vast majority of the other people arrested have also not been indicted, it seems like there would be good grounds for dismissing all of them. Do you know what's happening with that? Are you representing other people? Are other lawyers going to do that? And will they have the same judge?
They should have the same judge. The domestic terrorism cases were all assigned to Judge Greg Adams in DeKalb County. The challenge, though, is that the analysis, like the evaluation that the court does, is very specific to each defendant and to their cases. Whereas Jamie did ask or demand for a speedy trial and speedy indictment twice, other defendants haven't. Some defendants have as well. And so, it'll just vary defendant by defendant. But what we do know is that some defendants are similar position to Jamie, right? Like there are some DeKalb County cases that are even older than March 2023. We hope that the judge's order helps other people argue as well. What is great about what the judge decided is that he found that the state was intentionally delaying the DeKalb County cases, right? The order talks about deliberate delay, and so that will hopefully help the other defendants. I don't represent other defendants. I'm only representing Jamie right now, but we'll see what happens because these cases keep evolving.
What's at stake then in the RICO charges in terms of, I think it was 20 years in prison would be the maximum sentence. Correct me if I'm wrong. Do you think that if these charges get dropped for a lot of these defendants, that would have could have an impact on whether or not the RICO charges get dropped? And who's the judge on the RICO cases?
Yes, so the judge on the Fulton County RICO cases is Kevin Farmer. And I think the reality of only having one charge, right? Like if you are only facing the RICO, it is harder for the state to pressure a defendant to cooperate. When someone is charged with multiple accusations, it is easy for the state to say, all right, look, I'll drop these or lower that or give you a break over here in exchange of you doing something for the state, right? We see this all the time. The government brings 20 charges against someone and then in exchange of something drops 19, right? And you plead guilty to one. So that is a very big benefit of only now facing the RICO, that there's just less pressure on criminal defendant to take a plea or to make another decision in their case.
That was Javier de Jinan, an attorney representing one of the Stop Cop City defendants. Learn more about the Stop Cop City trials by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, KTAL in Las Cruces, New Mexico, KFUG in Crescent City, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.